One of the common themes on the GeoTrek podcast is that it doesn't matter how accurate our science is, if we do not effectively communicate that with our audience, we don't really make a difference in the end. Well, you're going to love this latest episode of the GeoTrek podcast. Tracy Sempier, a coastal resilience engagement specialist with Mississippi Alabama Sea Grant Consortium, is on the podcast to share what she's learned in more than 20 years of engagement as an outreach specialist. Hey everyone, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast, where we explore the world to bring you stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. Make sure you like, subscribe, and follow all of our content, both on your favorite podcast platforms and on social media, so you make sure to stay up to speed with all the exciting things happening here at GeoTrek. Well, you're going to love this episode with Tracy Sempier. I've known Tracy for a long time. She is at the top tier of engagement specialists. And I always turn to her actually for advice on like, how do you engage with communities? Tracy is a coastal resilience engagement specialist and Vortex Southeast outreach coordinator at Mississippi Alabama Sea Grant Consortium. She's a seasoned community outreach professional with over 20 years of experience as a researcher, evaluator, grant writer, and educator. You're going to love this conversation with Tracy. Again, she does such a good job of community engagement and shares with us some insights on how we can really engage with communities and make a difference so that we can help them be more resilient in the future. Well, without further introduction, let's jump into this GeoTrek podcast with Tracy Sempier. Tracy, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tracy, we've known each other for a long time. I know you've done extensive amount of work with Mississippi Alabama Sea Grant for a while. You were at the Gulf of America Alliance and just working with a lot of these partners, especially along the Gulf Coast and beyond, to do a lot of coastal resiliency engagement work. Could you share a little bit about the entities you've worked with and your affiliation now?
Sure. So I guess in my role as an extension specialist, I work with a variety of audiences. So just to give you an idea, one day I might be sitting down with a mayor and a floodplain manager and a city planner and other local government folks, and we might be discussing things like hazard mitigation plans and what actions the city can take, you know, to mitigate for future disasters. But then like on another day, I could be working with a local business to develop like business continuity plans to ensure that they get back up and running, you know, in a short amount of time after a disaster. And then even on like recently, just the other day, I was teaching a weather preparedness training. So I was demonstrating skills like chainsaw safety, how you properly remove debris after a storm, how you safely use a generator, all those kinds of things. So I really love my job. It's really different every day. And I have really enjoy getting to know the people that I serve. And so I've done primarily since about 2008, I've been doing that through Mississippi Alabama Sea Grant Consortium. And then I had a stint where I also worked hand in hand with the Gulf of Mexico Alliance, which is now Gulf of America Alliance. And we were doing work that was more like at a state level. So different audiences, depending upon the organization.
It sounds exciting. It sounds engaging. And I don't think you could ever get bored in a job like that, right?
No, not at all.
Let's talk a little bit about how you became a coastal resilience engagement specialist. I mean, that seems like a very focused career path. I mean, could you share about your path into that profession?
Sure. I wouldn't say that my path was a very direct path into coastal resilience work. I started off as a marine science major. So my bachelor's is actually in marine science and biology. And then I moved to the West Coast and did a lot of work there, more on how you translate that information so that different audiences can understand it. So that kind of helped prepare me for my role. And then I kind of came back to the Gulf and did my PhD work mostly in project evaluation. And so I think it was really that evaluation piece, because when you do evaluation, you really pay close attention to what people are saying. And so when I came on board at Sea Grant, I was piloting a tool where I was traveling all across the Gulf and interviewing folks at local government level. And I really started to get an understanding of the needs that people had immediately after storms. And one of the things I found was that nobody at that time really knew what the word resilience meant or what that looked like. And so that kind of led to a variety of pilot projects and demonstration projects and then small grant opportunities for local governments. And I think because I realized that all of the resilience that I was learning about is really all happening at the local level. And so I think for me, that really led me to want to try and help build capacity within communities to weather future storms. And so that's kind of how I feel like I'm contributing to building resilience. But it definitely was not a direct pathway to that.
Tracy, as you were traveling around the Gulf region, talking to people about this tool that y'all created and how they can be more resilient, are there a few like common threads that stood out to you, maybe that, you know, you'd see a community in Florida or Texas or Alabama that maybe had similar hurdles that they had to overcome?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when you sit down and when folks are ready to talk about these kinds of things after a disaster situation, I think that all too often, you know, we start to talk about the infrastructure and building back infrastructure resilience. And even some communities that were really interested in, you know, like, okay, well, what can we do to make sure that, you know, we're protecting our natural buffers? And they were talking about environmental resilience. But I think that something that has sort of stuck out to me across the Gulf was that nobody was really talking at that time about maybe mental health resilience and how you overcome kind of being part of a storm and then your community is bouncing back and people are exhausted and, you know, sort of what that recovery looks like. And so we were talking about like the things that we could see, but I feel like a lot of communities weren't talking about what you can't see. And I think that's actually become a lot more prevalent, like well-being has kind of moved to the forefront since then.
You know, Tracy, I'm so glad to hear that. I've been in a lot of disasters where, you know, the story that stands out to me is people say, I had the same neighbors for 30 years until the day of the storm, right? And then half of them left and never came back. And then all these new people came in and like beyond just the stress of the infrastructure is damaged or the electricity is out or, you know, the food and water supply, you get a lot of these, it seems like social impacts, right? And it sounds like you're saying some of that really maybe ties into like mental health. But now it seems like from what you're saying, you and other groups are addressing that maybe more than used to be addressed.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to think so. I mean, there is a term that is often used in like the health field, which is called allostatic load, which is what they refer to as like the wear and tear on the body that kind of accumulates when you're exposed to repeated chronic stress. So in this case, like repeated disasters. And so we've started using that term to describe how people who live in our region are dealing with compounding hazards, just like, you know, what we're talking about. And so I think that it's different to live in a region where, you know, maybe every once in a while there's a hazard. We know that it's not an if, it's a when. And, you know, those that compounding disasters over time really diminishes your ability, like you become fatigued. And so I think that we've now finally started talking about, well, what do we do about that? And how do we take care of ourselves and how do we take care of others?
Well, Tracy, talking about allostatic load, compounding disasters, there may be no better place in the entire country to really look at that than where you're at, for example, coastal Mississippi. We all know what happened with Hurricane Katrina. There was the Deepwater Horizon oil spill that also affected a lot of people in the economy there with seafood and beyond. So, I mean, you're in a part of the country where people have seen some mega disasters multiple times. I wanted to ask you, like, how have residents in this region overcome such hardships? I mean, how do they do it? Like, how do they make it through these multiple compounding disasters?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, you know, I think sometimes people that live in our region feel like they're always undergoing recovery, right? They're always in recovery mode. I guess like one thing that kind of sticks out to me, it does amaze me how many people have kind of persevered through these types of events, right? And one thing that really stands out to me, we have a family, the Zerlot family. They're a fifth generation fishing family that Sea Grant's worked with for a lot of years. And they used to have a really large fishing, boating business. business. So they would go out and you know, shrimp and always come back to the docks and sell their fresh seafood. But after a whole lot of, you know, economic downturns and hurricanes, they actually decided to diversify their business. And they took an oyster farming class from one of our fisheries extension agents. And now they actually own a world renowned oyster farm called Murder Point Oysters in coastal Alabama. And so they've since then weathered multiple natural disasters and the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, like you were just talking about. And, you know, that inspires me because I know it took a lot for them to step out of their comfort zone to diversify in that way. But it helps us to realize through our programming that that whole diversifying the workforce development and making sure people can switch from maybe one particular type of career to another working on the water is really an important thing. So I don't know, that just kind of stands out to me as how, like, maybe that one family, for instance, really made the best of their situation.
Well, that's a fascinating story. It sounded like they pivoted in a way to diversify their business in a way. And I'm not an expert on oysters, but it sounds like you're saying by going into oysters, it enabled them to weather some of these natural disasters that maybe they could not have weathered as well.
Right, exactly. And not only that, but, you know, they kind of built that. They built their knowledge that they already knew from the sort of the fishing, you know, they were like fifth generation in fishing, but they kind of, you know, took all those things that they knew about salinity and about the ocean and about what disasters could do, and they turned it into a positive, which I think is really incredible.
You know, what I love about that story, too, is that they reached out to Sea Grant because you had some experts there involved with the oyster industry, you know, to say, well, we, you know, obviously this family with five generations in seafood, they knew a lot about the coastal environment, but it sounds like they reached out to Sea Grant then to get even more resources to help them make this transition, you know, which I talk about a growth mindset, right? Like, hey, there are ways that we can pivot. There are some changes we can make to help us weather future storms. It sounds like they did that really well.
Yeah, absolutely. And any kind of role that we can help play in that is important. And I think that we have to think about that throughout, you know, do our floodplain managers, you know, what kinds of things that they need to be thinking about for the future. So I think that's our goal, is to always try to see like what's coming down the pike, you know, so that we can help with that.
Yeah, for sure. I know Sea Grant does such a good job getting out ahead of issues, you know, helping people know like, okay, these are potential hurdles that you're going to have that we want to help you get through. I wanted to ask you, with you and your team doing such an amazing job of engaging people in disaster-prone communities, what are some of the key lessons you've learned in your career to optimize engagement and positive impacts in communities?
I would say, I guess, always have something to offer when you're entering a disaster prone community. So I guess I can still remember very vividly visiting Rolling Fork just after the 2023 tornadoes and being tasked with conducting interviews with survivors. That's a tough time, right? Like, you know, they've just had a lot of damage in their area. But the Severe Storms Lab was really interested in learning about, you know, how did people receive the watches and warnings during that time so that then, you know, we could work to make that a better process. And so in those moments when, you know, their buildings are in rubble and the streets and neighborhoods are pretty much unrecognizable, I think showing compassion, even in simple ways, is important. So, you know, bringing waters, we brought in supplies, we offered rides to people for places, we helped pass out meals. And then the key there is just to go back again and again. So we didn't just go the one time and sort of, you know, take information from folks. We went back, you know, to find out, like, what are ways we can help? What are ways that we can help build, you know, resilience in your community? So showing up and just finding ways to offer assistance, I think, really means a lot to survivors in those moments, probably more than anything else. And so just listening to them, allowing them to share what happened, that kind of gets to the mental health piece I'd mentioned earlier. You know, don't try to fix it. Just listen, show empathy, find ways to be helpful. And I think that then they remember that, you build trust, and then you have a better working relationship, you know, down the road.
Tracy, I love that concept of being compassionate, showing empathy, and really starting with where are these people at, and maybe what are some ways I can meet their immediate needs right off the bat, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, I like that concept of what you said of you better bring something with you. You know, it's been said, if you're going to go out in the desert and engage with thirsty people, you better bring some water, you know, and that concept of that you're bringing, I guess, and that could probably be short-term supplies, but also like long-term. I mean, you and your colleagues have been at this for decades, helping everywhere from community leaders to local government leaders to small businesses get back on their feet. So it's like, maybe I'm wondering if, like, by going and helping meet some short-term needs or just building relationships, it might open up that opportunity for you to provide some of these long-term training and knowledge and resources to people.
Right. Absolutely. It snowballs, right? So maybe you have that brief interaction and maybe you're providing an immediate need, but people remember that. And then down the road, it offers you an entry point of which to kind of say, well, you know, what else needs to be done? And I think that sometimes we feel like resilience has to be these really huge projects, multi-million dollar projects, but that's really not what I have found over my years at Sea Grant. I have found that, you know, you can start small and you can get that momentum going. And then it feels like that snowballs into these larger things and these larger projects. But you got to get people interested and you have to get some momentum going, I think, first.
So that concept of starting small, I mean, for you, does that usually start by fostering some relationships? And then, like, if so, how do you get those relationships started?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've done a lot of have a lot of experience of just cold calling or just going to, you know, visit with people in person, listening, finding out what their needs are. And then that usually has led to, you know, a broader conversation about, well, you know, what other partners can we bring in and what kind, you know, what is like this high priority action item that we really want to work on together? Are we trying to work on stormwater management, you know, in our area? Are we trying to reduce flood insurance premiums? And typically, it's a topic that everybody can rally around, and it usually starts, you know, in those smaller one-to-one face-to-face meetings, and then thinking about who has this expertise. If we don't have it on our team, who else can we bring in? And I feel like those are the projects that really gain a lot of traction.
You know, Tracy, I have to say, most of the times I've seen you, it's been at smaller community workshops. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and in those types of environments, there'll be people from dozens of disaster-prone communities. But what I noticed too about those workshops that you and I would be at, it typically tended to be small to medium size, very relational. We're usually all in one session together, usually eat our meals together, as opposed to like a mega conference where there's 8,000 people and you leave there like, I didn't meet anyone. I mean, to what degree in your professional life have these small to medium type of workshops helped you foster and maintain relationships as well?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you brought that up because a lot of our communities in coastal Mississippi and Alabama that I serve, they are small to medium size, right? And they may not have a lot of capacity, but you mentioned food. And I think that's so interesting because that has kind of been a theme. Food really does bring people together. And so I know that just recently we started a disaster meal preparation course that has been really popular. And one of the reasons it's popular is because, again, there's food. It brings people together and you can talk about these topics in a way that it doesn't seem threatening or doesn't seem scary. But I think that the smaller groups make sure that folks feel comfortable talking, even if it's a potluck and other people bring food and we just all, you know, sit around the table. But even when there's not food involved, these smaller group gatherings, I feel like I can hear more voices, more people feel more comfortable speaking out and talking about the issues. And I think that when you start that way and people feel heard, then it helps, you know, the project or whatever you're trying to accomplish move forward. So,
yeah, for sure. And what you said was disaster meal preparedness, right? That sounds amazing.
So this stemmed from doing lots of different events, and I have like a go kit, and I would talk to people about a go kit, and I would bring out all these, you know, canned goods, and people would say, "Oh yeah, I just take the top off and just eat it cold," and I'm like, there is a better way to have a meal and to fix a meal for your family during a disaster time. So it occurred to me that after all these interactions and people really didn't know how to cook, you know, just food that they would have in their go kit. And so now we have little camp stoves. They're really inexpensive, one burner camp stoves that you can get at Walmart. And we show people how to take those canned and prepackaged foods and make a nice meal out of it that they can, so they can feel nourished even when they're in the midst of, you know, a very stressful situation.
Well, I love that. You know, that's a very practical thing. And like you said, it's resources available in our community. It might just be a skill set. A lot of people didn't know how to do that or did not know how to use those one burner stoves. I love right. that story. Tracy, recently I was on your LinkedIn page and I love this. You were featuring comics. So basically illustrated cartoons, how that can be used for risk communication efforts. This is amazing. So where did you and your colleagues come up with this, you know, creative innovation?
Sure. Well, I have to give full credit to my colleague, Dr. Justin Sharp. He recently joined our outreach team for Vortex Southeast. That's also part of C-Grant. And one of the things as we started talking, Justin has a real, you know, creative, just very creative mind. And so we were trying to toy around with how can we help people, like how can we convey some very serious situations, but in a way that doesn't paralyze people, you know, they don't become so scared that they feel like they can't take action. And so that's kind of where this concept came from, because you can convey a lot of different things in a cartoon. And the goal is to help people feel like they have control over some of these things in a disaster situation. So sometimes when you see this, like we might convey like a family that's kind of getting together and sheltering together, so that sheltering doesn't seem like a scary thing, because we've heard from a lot of our National Weather Service offices that people don't want to come to the shelters because they're afraid of what it might be like in there for them and their family. So we're trying to convey messages about, you know, sheltering and about, you know, how to be things you can do to help yourself in a severe weather situation, but it makes it less scary. And the cartoons actually, I think, or we think, as we've been doing this and developing them, helps people to take action in a way that they might not have if we'd scared them.
Yeah. And Tracy, looking at it too, it's so engaging, right? You're drawn into a cartoon as opposed to just a whole bunch of text on a page. By paragraph three, you're kind of your eyes are glazing over, right? It seems like right. a way to maybe capture people's attention in a different creative way.
Yes, that's true. And it really is good for all ages. It's not only for kids. So even though your kid might be drawn in it to initially, that kind of brings the adults over to your booth and it lets you have a conversation about, you know, important safety measures they can take.
I love that. Tracy, we're going to talk a little bit more about creative communication later in the podcast. Now we're going to take our mid-podcast break to talk about weathered wisdom. This is our favorite portion that we do with every guest. We wanted to ask you, what is an extreme weather event that you can recall that left such an impression on you that you'll never forget it? So this could be something that impacted you professionally or personally, but it's just an extreme weather event that left such an profound impression on you that you will never forget it as long as you live. What's your weathered wisdom?
Sure. So I have lots of these, but I will say the one that really sticks out to me is actually the Tuscaloosa tornado outbreak of April of 2011. It was a super outbreak, and I grew up in Tuscaloosa. And so when all of that was happening, I had an opportunity to go back immediately after the storms and really help with the aftermath of that. And so it was just a very surreal experience for me to be in my hometown where I had grown up forever and not recognize roads and, you know, not really be able to figure out where landmarks were in certain parts of town. That was really devastating. The church that I went to was pretty much leveled. We had a lot of big tents set up in the parking lot to hand out food to people in the area. And so that just has a real impact on me to this day, because I have a lot of family that still live there. So trying to check on the family members and then being there and kind of seeing it for the first time. But I will say, fast forward from 2011, and I've actually done a lot of work now up in that area. And interestingly enough, my daughter is at school there at the University of Alabama, and she is currently this semester working with the Office of Emergency Management to pass legislation that would put tornado safety information in every single dorm room, because she came from where we live in Mississippi and went up there and said, I'm used to hurricanes. You know, I didn't know anything about how to shelter for a tornado. So isn't it interesting that all these years later, there's still a lot of work to do, right? From even a past event.
There's a lot of work, but what an amazing story and what great insights from you and your daughter to say, hey, we have students coming from all over the place, some of them not familiar with tornado preparedness. That's fascinating. And what a great success story to get that information into the hands of all these students.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's super relevant. And so you would think that sometimes when we think that we've said the message enough times, or we're maybe even tired of hearing ourselves say a specific message, I think it's important that we remember that not everyone has gotten that message, right? And so you have to keep going. It's not just something that you can do one time and stop.
You know, Tracy, that Tuscaloosa tornado outbreak. I mean, we know Mississippi and Alabama, especially inland from the coast, get a lot of tornadoes, but that was just exceptionally catastrophic. I mean, I would imagine just a shock to the people there. I mean, so I'm just wondering, like, how do people move on from that? I mean, tornado outbreaks, in a sense, there's a randomness to them, right? I was just curious, in the days after that, I mean, it sounds like you were on the ground and this was an area you were very familiar with. How did people move beyond that in a positive way?
Well, I saw a lot of resource sharing, a lot of organizations that, you know, hey, your building is completely ruined, so, hey, you can come and you know, operate out of my building. You know, we'll move over and make space for you. I saw a lot of, you know, generosity on so many levels. But just trying to navigate just all these different homeowners and business owners and, you know, and faith-based groups trying to navigate the insurance process and, you know, how are they going to rebuild and should they rebuild and where were those things going to go? And so, you know, in those moments, in all of that chaos, you know, you try to look for those bright lights. And that's where, you know, that's where you started to see people really coming out and just, even if they weren't affected, they were helping others. And I think that that's what we typically see, you know, after disasters, which is brings hope, right? In a terrible situation.
Yeah, for sure. So many people were trying to come together and work together, you know, because it was such a mega catastrophe. And it was just good to see groups coming together after that event. Tracy, you and your team do such a great job at clear communication. What are one or two tips you can give our listeners? Like, when you communicate risk, when you communicate science, what are just one or two tips you would give people to do that better?
Well, you know, in the field that I work in, effective science communication is always backed by scientific study and data, right? And so, but what we've done is we try to take that data and we translate it into a simple message. So I guess that would be one tip. Try to make something as simple as possible so that it can be received in a lot of different ways from the audience. So for example, where we live, we're in an area that, you know, almost, because we were just talking about tornadoes. So like 50% of those tornadoes happen at night. And many people in our area don't understand that. And so they don't always have ways to receive communication. So we have a simple message that just says, have multiple ways to receive weather alerts, you know, and then the picture behind that or the infographic might be a nighttime tornado so that people start to think about, you know, what that looks like. So I think having clear, simple messages so that people know what action to take is important, because when they get too much information, then it's harder to process that and then do something about it. And I do think that the landscape for this is changing, right? I mean, and so we're having to learn what to do to change with it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, things are changing a lot. I love that focus, though, on keeping it simple. And what you're talking about there, say with nighttime tornadoes, it's giving them one piece of information that they can take action on.
Right.
So that, I mean, that's cool. You don't need to necessarily quote everybody's dissertation out there, right? Just that concept that we get a lot of night tornadoes have multiple ways of receiving watches and warnings, right? That in itself, it's an action item that's pretty simple for people to take.
Exactly. And then maybe that will lead to, oh, I'm not sure how to receive alerts on my phone. I should probably, you know, YouTube that and figure that out. Yeah. So that's the hope, is that if they don't know exactly what to do, that they are at least seeking additional information on what to do.
Tracy, you mentioned that we're communicating risk in a changing world. I mean, where are we going? Like, where does this sector, what does this sector look like, say, 10 to 15 years from now? I mean, what's coming down the road?
Well, so I kind of said that to see that, like, for instance, right now we're finding that a lot of people aren't necessarily getting their news and their weather from television anymore, right? And so the field of digital meteorology is really growing. And we see, especially like in localized areas and even a couple of digital meteorologists that are national, I think people really like being able, not being confined by just that short weather report. And so they like having like all these details, and they like the live streaming, you know, that these groups will have on Facebook. And so I think that we're starting to see that that social media and, you know, just digital platforms are playing a much bigger role in how people are receiving their information. So we have to, you know, learn to communicate that and be able to reach people on those platforms. And then, like, just technology in general is really advancing the way that we communicate about resilience. I mean, just think about just 10 years ago, you didn't have drones that could fly over communities. And now we have drones that can go out after and do damage assessments, you know, and they can live stream that on Facebook so that if someone has moved inland to kind of evacuate, then they can still see, you know, their home and know that it's okay. And know that they're, you know, that they're out of harm's way, but they still can check on their property. So I think that, you know, things are definitely moving in that direction. And I feel like we just have to be able to keep up with it.
Oh, it's the pace of it, right, is just tremendous. All these different social media platforms, the fact that you can follow multiple storm chasers live in an event, they're streaming. I mean, the amount of streamed information is insane right now. I wanted to ask you, just recently, unfortunately, there was a Cat 5 hurricane that hit Jamaica, and a lot of us were trying to get information. I was on Twitter/X, and I was amazed. Out of the first 10 videos I saw, I could tell 7 or 8 of them right off the bat were fake. I mean, they were showing roofs pulling off houses, but it was the day before the hurricane force winds even hit, you know? And in the comments, someone would say, oh, that was an old picture from 3 or 4 years ago. So this expansion and the acceleration of information is tremendous. But then how are we going to be able to discern, you know, what's credible versus what's fake out there, right? With all the misinformation as well.
Right. And that's a really big deal, right? Because, you know, there's a lot of things that can be AI generated, and sometimes that again, you know, induces fear, and especially when someone doesn't know. And we've kind of, I think, lost our ability to, we need to kind of help people understand what kind of, you know, information and what sources can be trusted, and sort of how to discern if those things are real or if they're fake, or at least give them the equipment and the tools that they need to be able to, you know, figure out, oh, maybe I should double check this, you know, maybe I should just at least fact check this. And so we know that that's not happening as much anymore. And we know that there are a lot of, like I said, just AI generated infographics and stuff out there. And so, but I think what I have found, that at least on a local, very local level, we have done a pretty good job of trying to help people understand kind of, here's some trusted sources of information, you know, and at least if you're going to get your information, you know, from other places, like if you are going to see something on social media, at least fact check it back with, you know, your National Weather Service, you know, office, or, you know, some trusted source. And I think that's really important. I feel like that's just a battle that we're going to continue to have moving forward.
Yeah, I love that concept of checking back with credible sources. And I know some of the emergency responders, storm chasers, a lot of them are tied into the community, right? They'll go to weather workshops. That you if you spend time in the community, you can start to discern who's legit and who isn't, right? And that kind of goes back to what we're saying about staying engaged, staying in workshops and different events and things like that.
Yeah, that's true. And I do feel like, you know, our emergency managers have a lot on their plate when there's an event. And I feel like, you know, we really have a role, those of us that are partnered, you know, with these groups, to try and help them. Because if they're out responding to an event, then maybe there are things that we can do if we're on the periphery, if we're not in the middle of that event. And that would be like, you know, kind of neighbors helping neighbors ideas. So if something's happening in Florida, what can I, you know, be doing to help convey, you know, that best fact-based information from where I'm at, knowing that they're trying to deal with the emergency on the ground. So,
Tracy, always great to talk with you, man. A half an hour went by so quick. We always have a good dynamic conversation, but I always love your perspectives on engagement and how to, you know, really engage with the public, with university partners, with, you know, even local government partners. I know you and your team are out there on the ground engaging with so many folks. We appreciate you taking time to come on the podcast and share this knowledge with our listeners as well. As we wrap up this podcast, I wanted to ask you, what's one last take-home message you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's always a pleasure to see you and see all the cool things that you're up to, Hal. But, you know, I guess for me, I think that you don't have to be an extension specialist to share your expert knowledge with others. And I think it's important that we all kind of think about our role in the community and how we can help build capacity and resilience. So even if your specialty doesn't happen to be in one field, you still probably have a lot to share and maybe some skills that you can help others build. And so I really feel like that whatever your specialty is, you know, find ways to use that to help build the resilience in your community. It doesn't matter if you're a scout leader or if you're doing this at work or if, you know, if there's some other organization. I just feel like the more that we collectively can help each other, there can never be enough of us that, you know, are trying to help build that knowledge so that we all have a better self-efficacy that we can do something right to help one another during these events.
Tracy, I love that perspective. And I know a lot of our listeners, they're passionate about disaster preparedness, about extreme weather. And I think they're really going to take that advice to heart. Tracy, thank you so much for taking time to come on the podcast and to share all these words of wisdom with our audience.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Tracy, for taking time to come on the podcast. Amazing insights. I mean, we could unpack this stuff for days, but three major things stood out to me in this podcast. Number one, I love this. We think of resiliency often as multi-million dollar projects. Tracy said in her experience, it really starts small and it starts snowballing after that. That's so important because a lot of times we can get discouraged or we're looking around at multi-million dollar grants and those don't often come through. But Tracy said, really show up and listen, be empathetic, be helpful. We talked a lot about the value of small to medium workshops, having food involved. People love coming around food. And I'll tell you, most of the times I've seen Tracy, it's been at these workshops with maybe 40 to 50 people. We're all staying in one session. We're eating our meals together. We can contrast that with a mega science conference with 4,000 people where you might go for a few days. It's overwhelming. It's huge. But you know, you leave with a handful of business cards and maybe not as many relationships. Really think this is amazing insight there from Tracy that you can start small with community engagement. It starts with a relationship. It starts with a way that you can serve or help. And it slowly grows from there. But as it snowballs, you'll get more opportunities to serve down the road. Number two, I love this story about the Zerlot family. This family that had five generations working in fishing and seafood, and they actually working with Mississippi Alabama Sea Grant Consortium decided to diversify. And they got training from Sea Grant specialists and how you can do oyster farming. This helped them diversify and helped them weather different disasters like hurricanes and oil spills and these different hazards they've had along the Mississippi coast. There are a couple of things I really love about this story. I mean, number one, the thing that stood out to me, for a family that has five generations of experience, for them to come to Sea Grant and say, could you help train us? That shows an unbelievable growth mindset. It also shows a lot of humility, right? They could say, hey, we have five generations. We're not going to anyone for training. Amazing story there of this family that said, hey, how can we diversify? And then Mississippi Alabama Sea Grant Consortium is there to help with workforce diversification, to help people really weather these storms economically and professionally. A great success story there coming out of coastal Mississippi and Alabama. And then number three, I really love that Tracy shared effective science communication. It really involves making our messages as simple as possible. So she talked about the nighttime tornadoes they get in Mississippi and Alabama, and working with the National Weather Service, a lot of their messaging has been some simple infographics that show a tornado at night and simply say, make sure there are multiple ways of receiving extreme weather messages overnight. It can be that simple. We don't have to get complicated. And our messaging, actually keeping things simple can improve engagement across all platforms and help people take that action item they need to do to protect their lives and their property. Tracy, I could go on and on. This was a great episode. And really enjoyed talking to you about this. We're learning here from Tracy Sempier with her more than 20 years of experience engaging with coastal communities. A lot of great lessons here. And again, you can find Tracy at Mississippi Alabama Sea Grant Consortium. You can find her on LinkedIn, where she's often posting latest information and insights as well. Thank you so much to our listeners for making us a top podcast on the topic of natural disasters. And of course, our friends and partners over at Blue Leopard Agency. We're working closely with Seneth Baker and Jeremiah Long, who does all the magic behind the scenes. He's our senior video producer, and we always produce really enjoy and appreciate his involvement investment with these episodes, making them sound so top-notch, sharp, and professional. To all of our listeners that listen to the GeoTrek podcast, thank you so much for your support. I'm your host, Hurricane Hal, and I'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.